Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. Our episode today will focus on ADHD, IEPs, and 504s. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. Today's conversation is with Dr. Carrie Heller. Dr. Heller is a licensed psychologist and founding partner at the Heller Psychology Group in Bethesda, Maryland. He specializes in the evaluation and treatment of ADHD, executive function issues, and co-occurring disorders. Dr. Heller is an assistant clinical professor of clinical psychology at the George Washington University, a national topic expert contributor on ADHD for goodtherapy.org. Dr. Heller has written several books on ADHD executive function, including his most recent book, Enhancing Executive Functioning and Study Tools Efficiency, an intentional short guide for the overwhelmed student. Welcome, Dr. Heller, and thank you for joining us today. I'm excited to discuss the topic of ADHD and specifically how it relates to IEPs, 504s, and school support. It's a much needed topic to chat about just to help parents kind of guide them with this information and how to support their kiddos in the classroom and also how to support their kiddos at home.
Hi, you're welcome. Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here and touch base today about ADHD.
What is ADHD?
So it's technically classified in the DSM-5, which is the criteria that's used for different diagnoses as a neurodevelopmental disorder. I mean, more specifically, you know, layman's terms, kind of what it does is it's a disorder that's associated with trouble with self-regulation. And so what self-regulation does is it impacts people's ability to regulate their attention, which also contributes to trouble with hyperactivity or excessive movement and can lead to impulsivity. So taking actions without thinking, saying things without thinking. Individuals with ADHD often have trouble paying attention, trouble sitting still, issues in making decisions, and executive functioning deficits underlie ADHD. And that involves trouble with task initiation, organization, and planning.
How would a parent receive a diagnosis?
Okay. Well, there are different ways of approaching it. I mean, the first step would be to first realize that there's an issue and then look at how best to address it. So what that would be, you know, a lot of times parents will first talk to their pediatrician to talk to them about, you know, my child is having trouble focusing, you know, what should I do from here? I think the key thing to keep in mind is that in a lot of cases, if someone's having trouble focusing, for example, there can be a lot of overlap between, you know, is it because of a true attention issue? Is it anxiety? Is it depression? There are lots of things that can impact it. And so in a lot of cases, you ideally want to get a thorough evaluation by a psychologist, but they do formal testing as well as a clinical interview and some rating forms to be able to get a clear picture of what's going on. In some cases, people will go just to the pediatrician, and the pediatrician will usually do some rating forms, maybe have the teacher fill out a form. And, you know, that's definitely a good starting point. But in a lot of cases, you're not getting the complete picture by just basing off of, you know, a brief, you know, 5-minute meeting with the child and rating forms.
Thank you. When the parent feels there is a concern, they speak with the pediatrician, they investigate treatments and therapies, they talk about treatment options. May include ADHD medications, behavior therapy, social skills group, asking questions about other treatment therapy options.
The best practice would be for the parent to know, you know, going in, obviously if they're listening to this podcast, they'll know that it's good to ask the pediatrician about the idea of doing formal testing and, you know, get a referral from them or, you know, someone in the community to be able to do the testing. I mean, some pediatricians won't give medication or do anything for treatment of ADHD without formal testing. You know, others will. I think it just sort of depends. But I think you're going to get a much clearer picture. And with testing, it's not just about, you know, do they have ADHD or not, but it's also about how do they function. So for example, are there any underlying learning disabilities that certainly if you just do a rating form for ADHD, it's probably going to be missed. You know, are there issues with reading? Sometimes if kids have trouble with, let's say, you know, reading comprehension, it can be an attention issue or it could be an actual issue just with reading itself. You know, or if someone has trouble organizing their ideas in written form, sometimes that can be associated with executive functioning, but it can also be part of underlying learning disorder written expression. So you really just want to go about getting testing in order to get, you know, the most complete picture. You know, the other thing you want to think about with all of this is what's the end goal? So, you know, if the end goal, for example, is just medication, theoretically, you know, if a pediatrician, you know, has reading forms, they feel comfortable, they can give medication. But, you know, usually a just getting medication is not going to sufficiently address all the issues associated with ADHD, and you're not going to have the documentation you need to get formal support at school anyway.
So I guess after we have that formal testing done, and then there's a report written and it gives the parents the information of looking at more of a whole picture of what is happening with a child, and that child then receives a diagnosis, now what? What would be your advice for parents? What advice do you give to your clients? What advice do you put in your reports in terms of you have a diagnosis, you have that information, so now what can a parent do with that information?
Well, that's a good question. There are a couple of key things that parents can do. I mean, you know, each case is slightly differently. You know, children sometimes present, you can present very differently with ADHD. But in general, I would say the key next steps would be, one, behavior therapy to work on, you know, behavioral tools to manage self-regulation, address, you know, underlying executive function deficits. I think that's sort of one of the most key things to start, because that addresses sort of some of the functional deficits, as well as, you know, low self-esteem or other things that can be contributing, you know, in this situation. I would say the next thing, you know, depending on the age and what's going on, might be, you know, some sort of executive function coaching. So working on practical time management, organization related study skills, you know, give the child or teen, you know, extra ability to, you know, learn practical tools and other things, and are also tutoring to work on, you know, any issues with school that are associated with it. So for example, you know, trouble with, you know, improving reading comprehension skills, or just simply an extra opportunity to review material if they're, you know, missing it. Because a lot of times, if you lapse in attention, you're going to miss bits and pieces of what's going on at school, and you may end up not learning stuff very well at times. You know, so that's sort of part two. Part three is medication. And, you know, for, you know, medication definitely is not for everyone, but for a lot of people with ADHD, it can be you know, a really helpful part of treatment in terms of, you know, direct improving focus, improving impulse control, and also helping kids to be and teens to be able to get started. So improving task initiation. The next step would be getting formal accommodations to the school. Those would be sort of the four main things I would see that I think are most important at the beginning with addressing ADHD.
You mentioned behavioral therapy to help regulate self-regulation function deficits. Executive function coaching to support weaknesses in organization, study skills, and practical advocacy skills so that you can be successful in and out of the classroom. And tailored with that, tutoring to support weak skills, whether that's in reading, written expression, or gaps in learning that may have occurred with attention. Number three, looking at medication. And the last one, receiving formal accommodations in school. So how do you prioritize those for your clients? How do you put those four items in order? How do you give that recommendation for that family as to where to start in that journey?
I think it's going to be individualized to a large degree, but I would say, but a lot of times they can sort of go in tandem. So for example, you can get behavior therapy and medication started around the same time, if that makes sense, as well as tutoring. And then you can also, you know, begin the process for accommodations at school. So I think it doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, one after the other. I think you can kind of do a couple of them in tandem.
Right. And then you would help guide that family as to where to get those outside resources.
Yeah. So for example, when I do testing, and, you know, most clinicians, you know, I believe do this as well, is, you know, you meet the family, you have a feedback session, you go over the results, but you talk then a lot about recommendations. So it's recommendations for, you know, other supports that are helpful, as well as things that the child or teen can be doing themselves, things the parents can be doing at home. So this way, you know, you sort of get this guidance with the feedback session of, you know, here's what we know now. There's ADHD, there's whatever else is going on, and here's what else you can be doing, and here are civic referrals for people that would be a good fit for this to help get you started.
Right, and that's so helpful for families, especially new to this experience and coming to a therapist and coming to an evaluator to figure out what they need to do to fully support their child, to be able to have that guidance from a professional to help give them, so they don't feel overwhelmed, that they have a direction that makes them feel comfortable and they know where to go in their community to find the resources that they need. And so what would you recommend parents do in regards to school and the diagnosis? So what would you recommend the parents do? How do you explain to the parents or support the parents when they need to go to the school and ask for help?
Right. And so, you know, again, I mean, there's some of the laws are slightly different from, you know, state to state, or sometimes, you know, theoretically within the county. But basically, in my experiences where I work, you know, typically, you know, what you would do is, you know, you would contact either, the teacher directly or the, guidance counselor, whoever's sort of in charge of special education services at school. And you would explain, my child has evaluation conducted. We would like to, set up a formal meeting to talk about additional support. And then, so you would have usually, Montgomery County call a screening meeting where you would go and, present the finding, or you probably send the report ahead of time. And basically you would talk, usually they'd, get teacher input, and you would talk about, based on what you're seeing, what there's in the classroom, what the report says, what would make sense in terms of, what's called usually a 504 plan or an individualized education program. But usually, at least sort of where I am in Maryland, that's sort of the two main options of what you can get in terms of, what the different sort of support services are called.
Right. You contact the person in charge of special education at the school. The parent does. You had mentioned that in Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland, they provide a screening where the IEP team or a team of educators come together. The report would be submitted ahead of time so that the school psychologist could review that report. They'd have input from the teachers of how they see that student in the classroom. And at that meeting, they would then decide if the student qualifies. And you had mentioned an IEP or a 504. What would that eligibility look like? And I know we're looking at two different laws there. Are you able to explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely explain a little bit about it. I mean, in a lot of cases, something like ADHD, I would say anecdotally, I think I end up seeing more kids, if it's just ADHD, that get a 504 plan as opposed to IEP. But a lot of it has to do with, what supports are needed. So if it's something that's more of a, pull-out services, something beyond, something essentially that sort of costs the county money. So an extra support plan, an extra service of some kind. That's usually under the umbrella of an IEP, where the 504 plan involves more kind of typical things like extended time or structured use and test environment, things that aren't necessarily an extra support service, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. No, thank you so much for explaining that to people. And so the student then qualifies. We have this screening meeting. The student qualifies. What are some accommodations? So if that parent receives that IEP or a 504 for ADHD, what would you suggest for support for classroom accommodations?
Sure. So there's definitely a lot that I would suggest. I mean, the other thing I will say too, it's important to keep in mind, is that it's great to have accommodations written in a plan, but they're only as good as, how well they're being implemented. So it's really important when you're having accommodations put in place that you make sure that they're realistic to be implemented. And if needed, try to make them specific about how they'd be implemented. Like, for example, one thing might be, let's say, extra check-ins, which that's great to have. But, even if it's not in the formal plan, you want to at some point figure out what is that actually going to look like?
And what have you seen work really well?
So there are a couple of things. So as far as in the classroom, being able to get an extra copy of another student's notes, that's, a combination that oftentimes is really useful because it allows kids to be able to not worry as much about taking their own notes. They still should be taking their own notes, but it allows them to be able to, if they miss something, have another set of notes or teacher notes to go off of, to, copy themselves after or review when they're studying for exams. I think that's really helpful, especially depending on the age of the child. Using adaptive technology such as timers and alerts can be really helpful. So if they need to pace themselves, whether it's on a test, or in doing classwork, things like that can be really helpful. Extra reminders for check-ins to make sure students know what their assignments are and that they're making, for long-term projects, for example, being able to check in periodically to make sure that they're on task and, have interim deadlines with the teacher can be really helpful. In some cases, depending on the school and the age, direct assistance with organization I've seen in some cases. One of the big ones also is getting regular teacher feedback, because sometimes parents have very little idea what goes on in the classroom, and unless there's a really serious issue, never get that information. And especially if they're working, if the child or teen is working with an outside professional, it's really helpful for that person to know, what's going on. So for example, one thing I do sometimes with teachers is we'll have a shared Google Doc. And they'll type in a few notes after each class, especially if there are a lot of behavioral issues. Then this way, I get a very clear sense of what happens each day. Were they on task? Were they disruptive? And the same thing to parents. And then this way, it makes it a lot easier to track things and to look at kind of what else needs to be done to make sure that they're functioning as well as possible.
I really appreciate you sharing. That's a great idea. The Google Docs between all members that are involved in supporting a kiddo. And I know just through what I do in Learning Essentials and the academic tutoring and academic coaching, that it's really big to have that communication and collaboration piece to make sure everybody's rowing in the same direction to support that student. And I really think that's an interesting way to collaborate, is through a Google Doc so everybody can see it. It's in real time, everybody can edit, and it's quick and easy to do. And that way decisions can be made and everything can be collaborated at one time, and we can really move in a fluid motion to support that student.
Right. No, I agree. That definitely makes a lot of sense. It's definitely very important. You know, the other thing, other sort of main classroom accommodation I can see that would be really important would be making sure that, especially as the child gets older, that they're able to advocate for and get access to their permitted accommodations. Because they do see in some cases, kids are not always fully aware of what they have. And in some cases, unless they speak up and ask for it, they're not going to get it. I've seen situations where, you know, when they've spent time, unless they ask the teacher for it, you know, and figure out a way to plan around to do it, you know, they just don't get it and they kind of go overlooked. So it's important that a child has a sense of what they're entitled to and that they're able to advocate it and get it when they're allowed to have it. I would say one other thing that's an interesting accommodation I see sometimes that I think actually is not always the best one. I think there needs to be more structure with it, is sometimes I see extended time for homework assignments. And so on the one hand, you know, for bigger assignments, if there's a legitimate need because they really need more time, that's one thing. But I sometimes see where that can sometimes backfire because then they always plan on using the extended time. And then because everyone else moves on to another assignment, things get backlogged and then they become very stressed. And there's also sometimes confusion over when an assignment actually is due with the extended time. So I think it's, you know, ideal with homework assignments, you know, not to blow on extended time for every single assignment, but to use it for the bigger ones if needed, but to have a very clear plan of, you know, when the assignment is actually due and make sure that, you know, if the extended time is being used, that, you know, it's tracked in terms of how they're doing it, when it's actually due, and that the other work's not piling up.
And do you have a recommendation for that in terms of tracking that extended time and tracking that homework and helping with that executive function piece?
Yeah, I would say for that, I mean, in general, I mean, I tell people, I think the more you can get to have stuff written down, the better. So for example, for big assignments, I would have, whether it's an, you know, an email exchange with the teacher, whether you, you know, type out or write out a sheet that you both signed, just something that says, you know, this homework assignment is due on this date. This is the, you know, extended time deadline. This is what has to be turned in by. And if you're working with a teacher on interim deadlines to check things, then that's sort of something very easy you could just put in as part of that too.
And what would that check-in look like? You had mentioned that earlier. What would a check-in look like for a student?
So let's say, I don't know, it's a history paper. Maybe it's, you know, by, you know, a certain date, they have the introduction written, and then they bring the introduction in and take 5 minutes or meet with the teacher at lunch and just do a quick look over and, you know, mark off that it's been completed. And then maybe they have 2 days later, they have to hand in the, or they have to show them the, I don't know, the first paragraph, or, you know, and then the second paragraph, or maybe it's, you know, section by section and then the conclusion. So the idea really is, I mean, when kids are younger, a lot of times teachers break down the assignments anyway a lot. But especially as kids get older, teachers don't always do that as much. So it might be, you know, write a draft of this paper and then there's no deadline, interim deadlines beyond, you know, starting and writing the draft. So the idea then is creating more of those interim deadlines for students that really need it to ensure that they're not leaving it for the last minute.
So when a parent is at that meeting and they're told that their child qualifies to have specific support and accommodations at school, what would be your recommendation? You know, we talked about vision statements and thinking ahead for that child. And oftentimes in moments like these, parents are kind of in the forest and it's hard to see the trees. So what would you recommend them coming to the table with in terms of ideas or suggestions so that they can truly be a part of that team conversation when it comes to defining what supports would best suit their individual child?
So I think there are a couple of ways to do this. One would be ideally in the evaluation report that they have, that hopefully there should be a good listing of accommodations I recommended. I think beyond that, having a sense of thinking about, you know, where do they see their child's specific struggles at school? So is it that they're having trouble keeping track of assignments, so they never remember to put the homework in the homework folder to go home? So figuring out where the difficulties are and then targeting that. So for example, maybe in that situation, it might be maybe an accommodation is that the teacher double checks to make sure the child put the homework in the homework folder before he goes home each day. So I think that part of it is really important as far as what to ask. The other thing, especially depending on the age, is to ask the child, you know, especially if it's a teenager, you know, like for example, what I do a lot of times when I'm working with kids is we'll actually make a plan. If they're going in for a meeting, you know, IEP or 504 plan meeting, whether it's initial one or, you know, review, we'll go in and we'll actually write out a list of, you know, based on what we've talked about, what they want, what they feel like would be helpful, because that can also go a long way in making sure that they know they're getting what they need.
I love that, to turn to the student because they know themselves. They know what it feels like when they're forgetting to turn things in, or they're knowing that what's impacting them. And as they age, those stakes get larger in terms of expectations, course expectations, grade expectations. So what is a good age to start that conversation with a child? Because you mentioned moving forward that they don't understand what they need or how to advocate. And in terms of what is a good age to start that conversation with the child of, you know, what is impacting you at school and where the troubles are and how can we plan for that support?
I mean, I think really at any age, I mean, you could even start with a kindergartner or first grader, just, you know, at least informally, whether they, you know, have a lot of formal difficulties or not, just to get a sense of, you know, how do they improve? But I think probably, you know, second, third grade is, I think third, fourth grade, especially, I think that's sort of a really kind of crucial time to really have that dialogue. Because the other problem too, is there's some situations where kids develop a lot of stigma around accommodations, around, you know, having ADHD. And if you can kind of talk about it from an early age, it oftentimes reduces stigma, where if a parents don't tell their child about it, and then they, you know, go through life. And then maybe in high school, at some point, they realize, oh, I have ADHD. And, you know, in some ways, they may be more embarrassed about it. Or, the, you know, I've seen times where they get very angry at the parents because the parents never told them. So I think just it tends to reduce the stigma and helps them be more empowered by knowing at a younger age. I mean, obviously, each situation is different. You want to make sure the child's, you know, sort of in a place, you know, mentally where they're okay to do it. You know, if you have a child that's really explosive and just can't keep it together to begin with, that's probably not the time to be talking with them in depth about all this.
Right. And so baby steps and understanding that student and where they are in their social, emotional needs, as well as their academic needs. Absolutely. We've talked through the gamut of a parent sees and recognizes that something may be going on with their child in terms of attention and focus and executive function and work input and output, and then how they go about identifying what those challenges are and then approaching the school to see what can be done to support that child. So what would be your kind of your golden nuggets that you have shared or heard over the years that really have supported parents immensely?
I would say if you have an inkling that there's something going on, I think it's worth exploring. Because, you know, some cases I see where, you know, a parent says, oh, I think my child's having this difficulty. The teacher says, oh, they're fine. In some cases, right, it's possible they're fine. But I think sometimes teachers don't always see the complete picture, especially if it's a large class and the teachers don't see what's going on at home. So I think, you know, if parents have concerns, I think it's important for them to bring it up, you know, with a pediatrician, you know, even just call a psychologist and just talk through what it is. Because, you know, psychologists may say, oh, you know, it might be worth doing testing, but, you know, I don't sort of see a strong need, or based on what you're saying, we should definitely do testing. But I think that it's important, if you have concerns, talk to whoever makes the most sense based on the issue, and don't just sit on it. Because I see a lot of the times where parents, you know, sit on it until their kids are, you know, in high school, whereas, you know, had they done things earlier, it probably would have made it a lot easier for everyone.
Well, that kind of goes with that early identification and with anything and with education as well, and starting to support that child early on as soon as we sense that there is something that's not connecting in a way that would make things smooth for them as they moved through the years and the academic rigor.
Right.
Well, I appreciate this so much. It's really enlightening to hear. I know that as a parent, it's oftentimes can be frightening and scary, but I'm glad that you came on and joined us today with our Learning Essentials IEP Pro Tips podcast to give us some insight on what to do when it comes to ADHD, IEPs, and 504. So thank you, Dr. Heller, for joining us. I appreciate everything and all of the insight that you have to offer. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.